Hey guys, if you missed out on the last conference in Nashville, Tennessee, you don't want to miss out on the next one. It's April 28th through May 3rd, Orlando, Florida, the Gaylord Palms Resort and Convention Center. You made a mistake missing the last one. You don't want that to happen again on this one. 5 days of some of the best training you're ever going to experience packed into one event. We have an early bird special right now, $50 off. Use 24 early bird on our website, streetcop.com. Look for the conference, click the link, register today. If you want to get significantly better at this profession in 5 days, don't dare miss out on the 2024 Street Cop Conference.
111.
You trying to be a street cop? I'm Sean Grogan, the instructor for body language for law enforcement, unmasking hidden facial expressions, and recognizing pre-attack indicators. I'm going to go over some questions that were submitted for me to answer. First one is, how do you articulate body language interpretations into your report? The situation is going to dictate how you articulate things in your report. I'm actually going to defer most of this question to Mark, who does the report writing class for Street Cop, but I'll tell you what I did. I write what I saw. I'm not going to use technical terms as far as I saw enhanced blading. No, I'm going to say I had the person giving me their shoulder. They were standing perpendicular towards me. Maybe I could write as a right angle. Their one side was away from me in a fashion that I could consider blading. I had that one side of their body was out of my point of view. Their left side was faced towards me. So along those lines, you're pretty much articulating exactly what it is you see. Now, the one thing that I would write was sclera. I like the word sclera to put in a report, sclera being the whites of the eyes around the iris. The reason being is it's a term that can be very easily described later on. You go to court, what's sclera? It's the whites of the eyes. Done. And you could look up sclera in the dictionary and it's clear as day. You can read it in medical books. Therefore, I think it's better to describe the actual movements, what you're seeing with the body. You write for a clenched fist. You could write clenched fist, bald fist, firm digital flexion, however you feel best about describing it so that you can relive it in your mind later on and better put it forth for other people to understand. Next question. When you were a canine handler, how did you balance being an effective canine team and building narc investigations? I'm currently my department's only canine handler and only dedicated narc investigator. Well, that's a pretty tough job to be the only canine handler and the only dedicated narc investigator. Because when I worked, we had a unit, it was a team, and there were several of us. And I didn't balance it. You might be able to balance, other people might be able to balance. I didn't balance. The canine came first for me. I was in an Explorer. It was unmarked, but guess what? You see a unmarked police Explorer and you're a drug dealer, are you going to pay attention to that? Yeah. At this point in time, they're pretty much what the Crown Vicks were 10 years ago. So you're sitting in something like that on the street. Well, guess what? I can't do all the surveillance that I used to do because I stand out like a sore thumb. So I had to rely on other people in the unit, and they also had their own investigations, and I'd have to stand by because, hey, we're going to go do this and we're probably going to need your dog. Okay, I'll stand by for you. Or I'd be in another city, run the dog for someone else. And I had to look at, where was I more valuable? Was I more valuable sitting in a Ford Explorer trying to conduct surveillance with the dog? Now, don't get me wrong, you can use the dog for surveillance depending on what type of dog you have. If you've got a lab or something like that, sure, you can go walk around with your lab. I had a German Shepherd. Could I walk around with the Shepherd? Yes. And sometimes I did. You walk through parking lots. Hey, can you get an eye on this over here or there when I'm already 2-3 blocks away? Not a problem. But if you got some crazy Maligator that when you walk, him's heeling next to you and going nuts, well, maybe that's going to stick out a little bit. For me personally, it wasn't a bounce. It was all in on the canine. You got canine, you've got to go for your research, your monthly trainings, well, depending on how much you have to do in your state, but we pretty much maintain monthly or even more with my dog. We went well beyond the attorney general standards from the state of New Jersey to keep the dog on point when he was working. So you're going to be worried, I would imagine, more for the dog than with the narc investigation. It's not going to be a balance. You give or take. You know, I just saw something, if you're familiar with Brad Lee, he's done like a business podcast. I just saw something pop up on my Instagram on him 2 days ago about having balance with his business. He goes, there's times where you go all in on the business. because something's wrong there. He goes, then I have something wrong with family. Then I go all in on family. I make sure my time's dedicated there. And I think that's how it has to be with something like that. Especially, it's very difficult for you if you're the only NARC investigator. I don't even know how you do NARC investigations at that point. Do you call on other agencies? I would like to know a little bit more about that, because that's pretty difficult. If you're going to be out there surveilling by yourself, there's no switching of vehicles or anything. That alone's a pretty difficult task to have. So that's pretty much it. I'm going to say you're going to have to choose one or the other, and it's probably going to be the canine. That dog's a living, breathing animal. Especially my dog almost died twice on me in relation to things that happen at work. So I was very, very cautious with the dog. After running the dog, I stayed with the dog for 20 minutes or more while everybody else is still searching. I still had to maintain. I want to make sure he was okay. I didn't get into anything I didn't realize. So I wasn't there searching with everybody else for those first 20 minutes. Depending on the neighborhood we were in, I might watch the dog more. If it's a heavily trafficked area, I don't want people over there banging on the car door. Now, it wasn't marked, but people realize there might be a canine in the car. I don't want anybody messing with the dog. Next question. What was your most successful pitch to flip arrestees/suspects into CIs? Hey, we can't promise you anything, but we can assist you in talking to the prosecutor in lessening or throwing out the charges. Again, can't promise anything legally, but you want to help yourself. And it was pretty much as simple as that. Either people want to help themselves or they don't. I was never one to push and push, because what happens when you do, you talk someone into working for you, then they fall off. You wasted your time and energy for 2 hours talking to this person, getting the information that might have been shoddy to begin with. And then later on, when you go to call this person, set up a buy, they can't make it because of A, B, C, or D. And this happens over and over again. So why waste the time? Either you want to work with me or you don't. And it was work with that person, not for me, for the most part, unless you've got someone that started giving you problems later on. But you're pretty much going to work with someone. Yes, you're obviously in charge. You're calling the shots, which needs to be made abundantly clear when dealing with the CI. But I also refer to the other instructors that teach courses on CIs and narcotics, because they more focused on it than me. Like I said, once I got the canine, I was in narcotics for, it was about 2 years once I got the dog, and that became my main focus. Did I still work informants? Yes. And that became difficult too, because where do you put the dog? You don't bring your dog to go meet the informant. You'd have someone else stay with the dog, or I'd pull it aside. It was, again, that balance, going back to the last question, really doesn't exist. Next question. Where do you find the most benefit from body language, i.e. street encounters, interviews, interrogations, etc.? I think you find the most value in all situations. On the street, you're looking at someone for safety issues to see if they're going to run. They start looking, the head starts going. It's a huge safety issue, especially running after somebody. We could say, oh, it's fun, you're in a foot pursuit. No, I didn't want to run. I don't want to run anywhere, number one. Number two, it would be comical. Oh, maybe I'll run there. Maybe I'll run there. That's what the people are telling you half the time, looking all over the place. But then we can't really laugh at it, because it puts us in such bad situations, running across highways, jumping fences. And an officer safety standpoint, it's more useful there. When it comes to interviews and field, when I say interviews, I'm covering all interviews, whether it be a field interview, standing talking to somebody, you got someone stopped for a possible crime that occurred in the area, or you got someone in a formal setting inside the box. Those are all interviews. And during those times, you're looking for it to assist you in detecting deception. I am going to repeat that, assist you in detecting deception. There's no A plus B equals C when it comes to detecting deception. I'm not going to say, oh, I noticed a possible discomfort behavior, so the person must be lying. I don't care if you see 20 discomfort behaviors that happen or occur when you ask specific questions and things are lining up to say, hey, this person might be lying. It might just be that they're uncomfortable dealing with you and they just don't like the questions you're asking. They don't like being in that setting. even if they've been comfortable the rest of the time, it's pretty much going to let you know, hey, I might want to ask more questions at this point. If you've been sitting with me relaxing for 15 minutes, not relaxing so much because you're not relaxed talking to a cop for the most part. You want to get them in the most relaxed state that you can. And you start hitting on questions, you notice a change in behavior, a change in the baseline. Well, what point did that occur? And I might want to ask more questions at that time. Where were you at yesterday around 2 o'clock? I was at work. Oh, that's interesting. I haven't seen a rapid nose inhale the whole time I've been talking to you. Maybe you've got sinuses and I just haven't noticed it. Maybe you didn't like the question. Maybe you're lying to me. I don't know. But there's a change in baseline behavior. I want to ask more questions about that probably in a little bit. I wait 20, 30 minutes. I ask again, hey, around like 1:45, maybe like 2:30, 1:30, 2:30 yesterday, where were you at? Maybe a possible sign of discomfort, grabbing the neck. Maybe they had an itch there and they had to itch it. But now I've got a grouping and cluster. And then you answer again, I was at work. At the end of the day, you're looking for verifiable facts and confessions. And I can't say I got a rapid nose inhale and the person grabbed their neck. They must be lying to me. No, I'm going to start asking more questions about that time frame. And then, again, you're looking for verifiable facts and confessions. I'm probably going to go to that person's job, see if they'll let me take a look at their login from the day before. And if they won't, maybe I'm going to apply for a subpoena depending on the circumstances. Body language alone is not going to equal deception. It's not going to say this person's lying. It's a tool that you use like anything else. The same way the polygraph. The polygraph is a tool. It's not a lie detector. That's a misnomer. For you to say, oh, I'm used a lie detector. No, you didn't use a lie detector. You didn't go ding, 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 we got a liar. The thing is a tool that measures physiological responses. And any polygraph examiner I've ever had in my classes, and I ask them, they tell me the same thing. I repeat what I heard years ago to when I get someone new in a class. I've heard that the polygraph examination is only as good as the examiner. Is that true? And I haven't had anyone disagree yet. Because if you don't know how to interview somebody, what is that thing? It might as well be an electronic box that you throw in a dumpster because it's got no usage if you don't know how to employ proper interview and interrogation techniques.
Hey guys, follow us on all social media platforms to include Instagram, Twitter, Facebook group. We have so much information going out every single day, and we don't want you to miss out on any of that stuff. So check it out. Go give us a follow.
Next question. Psychopaths and sociopaths. How does their body language differ from the general population? There's been some studies that have done, they've shown that they have diminished blinking. The average blink rate, 16 to 20 times per minute. Other studies have showed different rates. You're not out there counting blinks. However, if you got someone that's not blinking, well, we've all dealt with people in the past. We're like, wow. But based on either what they did or the behavior, we might think to ourselves, wow, this person might be a psychopath or a sociopath. However, we're not giving them the tests. We're not giving them a test to mark it down on the scale if they score high on the psychopathy test or not. But you have those inklings. You're like, something's off here. You'll notice, think back to yourself, how many people you've had with diminished blink rate. And there's lots of reasons why blink rate can speed up and they can slow down. But they've found that blink rates are diminished with psychopaths and sociopaths, as well as head movements. And one of the reasons they believe that the blink rate's diminished, one of the theories, is that they have a diminished fear rate. Now, what emotions they have depends on which research psychologist you speak with. If you follow the research from Dr. Paul Ekman, he said he believes that they have the same 7 universal emotions that are shown in the face around the world, and they have the same universal triggers. What do I mean by that? A broad sense of why that emotion occurs, such as for fear, a threat of harm. Well, what exactly are you afraid of? It differ from person to person. Now, the amount of fear the person has, again, can be argued depending on the psychologist. So many believe that they have, if you read up on it, they have diminished fear. Depending on who you speak with, they have different theories. And that's some of the differences with psychopaths and sociopaths. Is there universality to pre-attack indicators? That's a great question, and I don't have the answer because I'm not aware of any research that's been done around the world four pre-attack indicators alone. If you watch videos from around the world on fights in other countries, South America, Europe, Africa, Australia, you will see in the videos the pre-attack indicators that I go over, such as pin pulls. You will see foreshadowing, eye foreshadowing, firm digital flexion, balled fist, clenched fist. Especially with the balled fist, clenched fist, it's one of the things that you'll see people, that's how people fight. Is it the only thing people do? Of course not. People grapple, they kung fu fight, they throw bows, they throw knees, all other different forms and tactics when it comes to hand-to-hand combat. However, one thing you do see around the world, and there might be cultures out there that I'm not aware of that don't throw fists. That's why I stay clear of using the term universality when it comes to pre-attack indicators. Because for something to be truly universal, you'd have to see it in places that are so remote where they don't have contact with the outside world. And I haven't done that research. And guess what? There's no videos for that because they don't have contact with the outside world. But you will see in videos from around the globe that, yes, these pre-attack indicators will occur very often prior to fights. The look away, the look over the shoulder, the pants lift, obviously the shoulder drop back if someone's swinging, and the three forms of blading, the enhanced, the slight, and the prominent. Are there any evolutionary theories regarding the components of emotional facial expressions? One of the things that they have a theory for is for disgust. The reason you have a nose wrinkle is that it's trying to block off the nasal cavities, because a lot of things that are disgusting are odors. A lot of odors are disgusting, and you're trying to block off that nasal cavity. We say evolutionary theories. If you look at the social functions of some of the body movements we have, if someone freezes and they flash fear on their face and you're out somewhere in a jungle or forest setting or in the mountains, you might stop and try to look around yourself. Why is this person flashing fear? Is there a snake on the ground? Is there a cougar around? And there's also the theory that the social function with disgust. Someone flashes disgust. You go out to eat and you get an appetizer. The person takes one of the nachos or french fries or something's got cheese on it. They take a bite. They flash disgust. Are you going to take a bite right away? No, you're going to hold off for a second and say, hey, well, what's wrong with this food? I don't need to eat food that's gone bad. They have social functions. Also, they say that you could recognize if someone's sad so that you can better deal with that person, that especially if it's a close friend or family member, and try to assist them in figuring out why they feel that emotion. And those are great questions. I was happy to answer them. Frankie, do you have any questions for me? No, Frankie doesn't have any questions for me. If you guys have any more questions for me, I can be reached at SeanGrogan@StreetCop.com. That's SeanGrogan at StreetCop.com. On top of that, Sean Grogan Body Language on Instagram. I post there very often. A lot of pre-attack indicators, a lot of information on body language. The reason I like posting on there, especially if you've been in my class or even if you haven't. I've had people listen to my podcast and show up my classes like, hey, you know, I was dealing with somebody and I was able to keep myself safe because it's something you brought up on a podcast. Just hearing it in your mind and be able to visualize it to yourself. But even better, you go on Instagram, I post stuff, you can see the actual pre-attack indicators. If you're a visual learner, could be a 10 second clip, could be a 30 second clip. Bow, took a look at it, and then you move on. So thank you guys for listening and stay safe.
Hey guys, check out our upcoming training at StreetCop.com. Don't forget, we have 50 instructors nationally teaching a variety of topics. These are the best classes you're going to experience in your career. We make sure of it. You're going to love it. I guarantee you, you're going to be thankful that you went. Check us out at StreetCop.com for all upcoming classes in your area.